time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jonah Raskin. Jonah Raskin is the chair of the Communication Studies Department at Sonoma State University, where he teaches media law, reporting, and media marketing. For nearly two decades, he was a book reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle and a cultural critic for the Santa Rosa Press Democrat. He is the author of numerous books, including The Mythology of Imperialism, Out of the Whale, Growing Up in the American Left, an autobiography, For the Hell of It, The Life and Times of Abbie Hoffman, American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the Making of the Beat Generation, and his latest book, The Radical Jack London, Writings on War and Revolution. Jonah, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Good morning. Yeah, great to be here.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your latest book, The Radical Jack London?
Well, Jack London wrote a lot of books. He wrote about 50 books in 16 years, but he's been remembered largely as the author of dog stories, and he did write some good dog stories. He wrote The Call of the Wild about Buck, and then he wrote another one called White Fang, and their companion pieces. But he wrote a lot about politics. He wrote about war, revolution. He wrote a book called The Iron Heel that was published in 1908. That was about the coming of a dictatorship to the United States, and it's about a civil war that takes place, and it's a futuristic novel. And he wrote published a collection of essays called War of the Classes, about how there are social economic classes in the United States, and he wrote there was a collection of essays called Revolution. For 20 years, he was a member of the Socialist Party of the United States and spoke on behalf and wrote on behalf of the Socialist Party. So most of that part of Jack London, which is a central part of who he was and what he did, ignored, neglected, omitted from literature and the historical record. So I wanted to salvage it, resurrect it, and bring it to people's attention. So that's why I did The Radical Jack London, which is a collection of little known of his writings with a long essay by me about him and where he came from and how he became political and the evolution and development of his politics. So I think Jack London is he's a very fascinating guy because he was complex. He did a lot of things. And he is a pivotal American writer. He started to write at the end of the 19th century, and he read all of the books that we now recognize as classics, and the books by Herman Melville and James Fenimore Cooper and Mark Twain and Edgar Allan Poe, and he loved all of them, and he wanted to continue the things that they were doing. Sea stories and ghost stories and Huckleberry Finn like works, and he did. Some of his early work was imitation of those writers. So he kind of put a capstone to so much of American culture of the 19th century. But then he also initiated a lot of what would happen in the 20th century. He wrote the Iron Heel, which I mentioned. He also was a surfer and he was a boxer. He wrote about bullfighting and all those kinds of things Hemingway would later do. He wrote a book called The Road about his experience as a hobo traveling around the United States that inspired Jack Kerouac to write his book On the Road about his experiences. So he was a father of the Beats. And he was also in the 60s, there was a student radical organization called Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, and Jack London and Upton Sinclair created the grandfather organization of SDS. It was called the Intercollegiate Socialist Society in 1906, and Jack went around talking on college campuses to students and urging them to to read socialist books, to become politically active. So, yeah, I would say in the 60s that we say it has to be relevant. And I think that Jack London is still relevant today and worth reading. I mean, right now I'm rereading one of his novels that's called The Valley of the Moon, and it's a great love story, and it's a love story that's set against the backdrop of strikes and clashes between the workers and the militia that's called in, and it's really, really well done. It's an excellent book. If people want to read one Jack London book this year, I would say read The Valley of the Moon. It's so alive.
So talk about some of his writings that specifically focus on war and revolution.
Yes, well, he has a short story that's called War. And it doesn't specify what war it is, and it could be almost any war. And it's about it could be the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War. It's about, the main character is a scout. He's sent out to see if he can reconnoiter the enemy and see where they are. And so he's on horseback and he has a gun and a rifle, and he does see an enemy soldier, and he could shoot him and kill him, and he doesn't. He rides off, and the next day the enemy soldier has the opportunity to kill him and does kill him, the same soldier that he has seen. So and he kills him at a great distance because he has this sort of high-powered long-range rifle. And so London was very aware of the ways that technology had changed war in the 20th century. In 1904, he went to Japan and Korea for William Randolph Hearst, was kind of like the Rupert Murdoch of his day. He had this media empire. He went to cover the war between Japan and Russia. And he had the same kind of experiences that reporters would have in the first Gulf War, and then also in the invasion and occupation of Iraq, where they were not allowed to move around. They were embedded in one particular place, and where they were, their stories were censored. So he had this experience of censorship of war reporters by people in the government, and also the ways that technology, it was no longer like one soldier facing another soldier like up close, but these sort of weapons of destruction from far off that were sort of wiping out regiments and destroying civilian population. So the short story War is very gripping. And then I would also say that the essay called Revolution, now that he first gave that as a talk, as a lecture, and he started giving that to students at the University of California at Berkeley in January of 1905, and he traveled across the country that whole year giving this talk, and he ended up at Harvard and at Yale, and he had people, he talked to tens of thousands of people. And so that is a Jack London evolved politically. He started out as believing that people should vote for Socialist Party candidates, go to the polls, and he himself ran for mayor of Oakland twice, in 1901 and 1904. And he got radicalized, some by developments of the time and things that were happening internationally, and came to believe that it wasn't going to happen peacefully. The kinds of changes that he wanted to happen were not going to happen peacefully because, well, he would when he was traveling around the United States in 1905, and he was giving his speech. He also gave the speech to millionaires because there were clubs and organizations of millionaires, and Jack London was the best paid, most famous writer of his day. So they would also invite him to speak to them. And he said, well, you know, we want to have the 8-hour day. We want to have an end of child labor. We want to have, equality of opportunity. And these millionaires that he would talk to would say, well, we're not going to do that. If you, we're going to stop you. We're going to stop you. We'll use the troops and we'll call in the militia. That's not going to happen. So he came to realize that, or to feel that if there was going to be the kinds of thoroughgoing changes that he wanted, it was probably going to be necessary to have some kind of, there would be an inevitable clash because the government would call out the troops and which would repress the political movements that were happening. So he did, and that was happening in his day. He also, he became, he liked the organization that was called the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, also popularly known as the Wobblies, and he loved, Bill Haywood. And there was a trial, there was an arrest of the leaders of the Wobblies, and they were taken secretly from one state to another in a railway by railroad car, and they were put on trial. It was there was somebody who gave false testimony against them, and it was the president of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt at the time, got involved with the case and said that they were guilty, and it was a frame up. And Jack London wrote about the trial. He brought it to the attention of people around the country. Clarence Darrow, who was one of the most famous labor lawyers of the time, defended the Wobbly leader. So Jack London was aware of the ways in which the courts were being used by the mine owners and the government to clamp down on the labor movements of the day. So the ways that democracy was not a reality and was being betrayed by the power elite. Yeah.
So he, at some point, thought that obviously voting wasn't going to work and people needed to take it to the streets.
Yes, exactly. Take it to the streets to demonstrate. He did become disillusioned. And shortly before he died, he resigned from the Socialist Party. So Jack London, he's also interesting, politically he's interesting, and he's also interesting in terms of his personal life. So I would say that today, if he was alive, he would probably be described as bipolar, because he had these incredible mood swings. I mean, he was manic, he could be really manic. I mean, writing 50 books in 16 years. You have to be really energized and he would be very optimistic and about, you know, anything is possible. Human beings can change the world and we can make the world a better place and then at other times he would say he would get really depressed, and his own diagnosis of himself, he said, I have morbid anxiety, I have this sort of long sickness, I have the blues. He felt really alone and isolated for much of his life, and he became a socialist partially because he liked the political ideas, but also the Socialist Party gave him a home, it gave him a family, a sense of belonging. Because he'd grown up and he felt like he was an orphan. His own parents didn't want him. His mother gave him to an African American woman in Oakland to be raised, and his foster mother was the only real person in his life as a young person who loved him. His own mother didn't love him. His biological father didn't want to have anything to do with him. So yeah, he had this powerful, yes, this tremendous of loneliness and socialism and the Socialist Party gave him the sense of belonging and writing for a cause, and that was really important to him. There's a lot of really good Jack London. I mentioned The Road, and so I also recommend that book about his travels as a hobo. Seeing America from the point of view of people who are down and out, who are homeless, who don't have jobs, unemployed. And then he also, when he was traveling across the country as a hobo, he was arrested and put in jail, and he wrote about his jail experiences in The Road. And he also went to England at the start of the 20th century, and he was there for the coronation of King Edward. And so he describes the pomp and the ceremony of the coronation and the British Empire, and then the British working class people who are living in poverty in the slums, and this great contrast. And in order to do that story, he changed his name, he changed his appearance, he blended in with the people who were living in poverty. So he was also one of the fathers of what became known as the New Journalism in writing. Living the story that he was writing about, and not coming in as the observer to ask questions, but really getting the feel of what life was like for these people in London.
And what book was that in?
That's called The People of the Abyss, and so all these books are in paperback. You know, people can go online and get them, and there's all the books that I've been talking about, I have excerpts from them in my collection, The Radical Jack London, so people can get a taste of Jack London, and each one of the excerpts from London's work has a mini essay by me about how setting up each one of those stories and how he came to write them, what they mean, how they were received. I think those are helpful for an introduction to Jack London. I think The Radical Jack London is a real good introduction to Jack London, and I'm really proud of it. Yeah.
Do you think back in the early 1900s, was that when socialism was at its peak here in the U.S.?
It was growing, and that was a time when Eugene Victor Debs was running for the presidency of the United States, and I believe it was in 1920 when he was in jail, where over a million people voted for Debs when he was running for president. So that was also... Jack London was born in 1876. He died in 1916 at the age of 40. He was still a young man. I mean, and he burned himself up and burned himself out, and so he was aware of. So when he was dying was at the time when modern communism was getting going, and some of the people who've written about London have said that, well, if he had lived, it's very possible that he would have become a communist and joined the Communist Party. That is possible. He knew there was a revolution in 1905 that he was aware of and wrote about that was brutally suppressed by the Tsar and the troops. And he was instrumental and helped to give aid to Russians who were injured, arrested, and jailed. And so he was following political events that happened in Russia. And so Just as Jack London was dying, there was another American by the name of John Reed who came along and who had written about the Mexican Revolution, insurgent Mexico, and went to Russia and wrote about the Russian Revolution, and that was called 10 Days That Shook the World. So I would say that John Reed was carrying on one of the legacies or one of the traditions of Jack London. In the 30s, Jack London was popular and read in the 1930s in this country because it was a time of labor agitation and a working class power and resurgence, and people looked back at Jack London as one of the fathers of what was called proletarian literature, one of the fathers of working class literature. He knew what working class life was like, and he wrote about it really well. There's a short story in my collection that's called The Apostate that's based on his own experience as a boy working in factories. And so when he talked about child labor and underage kids working in factories, he was drawing upon his own experience.
So people in the 30s were still aware of what we would call today some of his more radical writings, yet today in our schools he's the guy who writes about dogs. How did that era focus on his writings get changed over time?
Well, it was partially the doing in the Cold War and McCarthyism, where Senator Joseph McCarthy was, well, there were investigations of people who were radicals in Hollywood, people who, left-wing people who were writing for the movies, like Dalton Trumbo, lost their jobs. That was the kind of, I would say, original political correctness of the 20th century, where publishing companies stopped issuing books about radicals and radicalism. People who were working in TV and radio lost their jobs. So there was this real, in the 50s, and beginning a little bit earlier in the 40s and 50s, and there was this a blacklisting of writers and excluding radical writers and radical books from the curriculum in colleges, because teachers who would teach Jack London's radical books, they would be ostracized, and they wouldn't get tenure. And so it took the 60s for to come rediscover some of these radical books by Jack London. Yeah, the political upheavals of the 60s, people said, well, one of the things that does happen in the United States is there's this kind of political amnesia where people forget that we do have a tradition of radicalism and protest and upheaval that goes back to the beginnings of our society. And people like Tom Paine, who is one of Jack London's heroes, and writing about revolution and the rights of man, and I mean, there have been times when Tom Paine has been excluded from history and from the teaching of about the American past, or in the 60s there was the whole rediscovery of the abolitionists and from the pre and post Civil War era. So London was also very aware of that we have to fight, or it's important to fight, to remember who we are as Americans and to preserve parts of our culture that, say, the official arbiters of taste and history often exclude from the history books. Yeah.
So I would say from your writings, I mean, that qualifies you as being a historian. What's your take on where we are, where this country is currently with this recent presidential election? Do you anticipate any real change on the horizon?
Well, I think that if there is going to be, there will be changes, yes. The question is, will they be changed? Who will the changes benefit? I mean, the world is changing. It's changing very rapidly. A lot of people have liked to think that that they're in control. I mean, I think that one of the things that the Bush years have shown is that people of wealth and power, the world has gotten totally out of their control. I mean, they thought that they were, what they thought they were doing in Iraq and what they thought they were doing it to the economy was totally blind and destructive to the country as a whole. So I have heard people say that to look and expect that Obama himself and the people around him are going to make the changes. I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that the only way there's really going to be changes if all of us, all of the people who elected Obama and canvassed and talked and organized and protest, all of us continue to be active and not to surrender our inalienable political right to participate. I mean, democracy only happens if people take on the responsibility of being active political persons. As soon as you give it up and you say, well, okay, the other people are going to do it, well, then you no longer have democracy. So wherever people are and whatever they feel is appropriate needs to continue, and certainly looking at the headline today, Boeing to slash 4,500 jobs. Those are the kind of stories that we've been seeing week after week, month after month now for a couple of years. I'm sorry to say I don't want to see it happening, but I think that there's going to be more stories like that. So I believe there's going to be more people out of work. There's going to be people who are going to be hungry. There are more families who are hungrier, who are losing their homes. So I do think that there needs to be, one of the national news magazines had a cover after Obama was elected where they depicted him as FDR, as Roosevelt. And the government is going to have to step in and help people, help working class people in similar ways that the Roosevelt administration helped people in the 1930s with putting people to work, building, our infrastructure. We know that all of our highways, our roads, our schools need improvement. The government is going to have to put money there. The government is going to have to help ordinary working class people and not just the fat cats at the top, not just bail out those people. I would say that all of us need to raise our voices and demand that happen and not expect that everything that we need is just going to be given to us. Raise our voices. Yes.
All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Mike.
Again, we've just been talking with Jonah Raskin. He is author of the new book, The Radical Jack London, Writings on War and Revolution.